Hello, welcome to the Face of Pro-Life. Today I'm speaking with Darlene Wagner. Thank you for joining us today, Darlene. She's our producer, and she knows a lot about pro-life movement, and I really wanted to pick your brain about an article I read recently. I'd like to first read the article to our audience, and then we can discuss it. The article is by Matt C. Abbott, and it's called Quiet Euthanasia. Hundreds of thousands of patients are killed in the world each year in this manner, and no police or district attorney will act to investigate or prosecute. These are the alarming words of Ron Panzer, who is the founder and executive director of Hospice Patients Alliance, which is an organization dedicated to preserving the original mission of hospice care and exposing the pervasive problem of quiet euthanasia in the hospice industry. Responding to a reader whose mother did not receive hydration in her final days and died in hospice under distressing circumstances, Panzer wrote, "It is terrible to hear about how your mother died. Knowing it does not appear to be anything like a natural death one would expect with good pain management as hospice is supposed to provide. Dehydrating a patient to death is known as the third way," says Panzer. "It's a way of sidestepping the laws against medical killing, but assuring just as sure a result, death. It's extremely common." I think that's so alarming. Panzer continues, "EU has a way of mixing in truth with untruth, partial truth rather than whole truth, or using something appropriate at one time but misusing it at another time. In the active phase of dying, the very, very end, a person does not eat or drink naturally, for he or she is truly dying. The individual's organs and bodily systems are shutting down. At that time, it would be inappropriate to provide food. He or she would choke on it, or it would be aspirated into the lungs, and a good amount of fluid would easily go into the lungs. But if one deprives a patient of food and fluid before he or she is at the very end, the very, very end, the patient is dying not of their terminal illness, but of dehydration. There's not enough fluid in the circulatory system, and it collapses, causing death. It looks peaceful if the patient is sedated, which is often the case nowadays. Regarding sedation, Panzer warns that a natural death includes total sedation only if the patient is terminally agitated, uncontrollably, dangerous psychotic or delusional, or in severe pain where strong medications alone do not adequately manage the pain. To sedate without real agitation is a choice to kill. To dehydrate before the patient cannot take fluids is a choice to kill." Panzer says that death through the third way is the most censored story in the United States, perhaps the entire world. And what about the quality of life catchphrase used by some in the medical community? "Quality of life is the camel's nose under the tent that allows this type of killing," says Panzer. "Society has brought into this due to diligent efforts of the Euthanasia Society of America and its successor organizations through 80 years of work. When food and fluid being provided to a patient was reclassified as a medical treatment, euthanasia advocates scored their greatest success in their ongoing effort to be able to euthanize any patient they wish. This is how the abused and neglected and not brain dead Terry Schiavo was murdered with court sanction. The media lied repeatedly and unfailingly about her actual condition." So, Darlene, I know we all watched as Terry Schiavo was dehydrated and starved to death. And most of us, understandably, were outraged. But according to this article, this is happening more and more. And we don't know about it whatsoever. And I know that you have had some experience with dying people and death itself. So could you give us a little idea of what's going on and how can we combat this?
Oh, I think that this is the most succinct article that I've ever read. This is what we've been thinking and talking about. We've been discussing what's been going on in the hospitals among our loved ones and friends and acquaintances. And this is establishing the first foundation of understanding that I believe is very understandable to the public. How the death is taking place in a hospital and how it happens in the case of a hospital or in a hospice, is that there is a judgment made by the staff that the person who is dying, death should be hastened because of mercy. And under these conditions, they begin to remove hydration and nutrition from them.
And water is so basic. I mean, we know that. You cannot have life without water. So how could we be denying, just the most basic?
Because they're saying to themselves, and I'm only explaining where they're coming from to know how we can combat this, is they feel they're offering compassion to somebody who's dying. Better to die sooner than later, because the sooner you die, then their pain will end. Your death sequence will end. They're doing you a favor. They're doing a family a favor if they have a 93-year-old patient that could live for 2 to 3 months and they have to go to and fro from the hospital. That if they just begin the sequence, and they do it, as they said, it's a secret. I mean, it's known that everybody's doing it, but it's not verbalized. Mm-hmm. We're not discussing it. We are right now on our show. But for the most part, the general public doesn't discuss this.
I don't know why more people aren't shocked by it, but I do understand. I've had conversations with people who have had relatives in hospice, and they have seen this, where the patient is dehydrated, and it does shock people. Just the average person, not the people who are in tune to this, but just a lot of normal average people do see this, that there's something wrong, and they're asking questions as why are we allowing this to happen?
And what's going to happen when we have insurance that wants to cut costs? They'll just move up the date of death. They'll just move this up so that they'll select more and more younger and younger individuals, or people who have less, let's say, who are not even in a dying
right.
spiral.
Like Terry Schiavo. She wasn't dying.
No, she wasn't. In fact, do you realize that it took her so long to die?
Yeah.
That means that all her organs were working.
Yeah.
That means that her body wasn't ready to die. That's why they had to withheld hydration and nutrition for almost up to 4 weeks. That's a long time to take somebody, would take somebody to die. That meant she was so healthy.
And she was holding on for dear life.
Yes.
Literally. What happens to the body? I know they said that in a natural throes of death, they say that that organs start to shut down, and they're not. If the organs shut down, they don't require water or food and energy. But if the body is in the process of dying, but not yet to the final stages, hydration basically shuts down the circulatory system.
You need to be hydrated within probably 12 to 24 hours. You really cannot live without a form of returning hydration into the body. You can go for days without eating,
right.
But you cannot be unhydrated within 12 hours. Eight hours is probably,
right.
That if you didn't drink all day and you were busy, in about 4 hours you'd be thirsty. And 8 hours you'd really be thirsty. And in 12 hours you'd be like, and 24 hours, your body would be crying out for hydration. And it's the same thing with someone who is in a dying state, but it would be less amounts. It would be, as you see, their mouth becomes, very dried out and chafed. They may not be able to drink a great deal. Their body might be shutting down in terms of their kidneys. They may have congestive heart failure and retaining a lot of fluids, but they need hydration nevertheless in small amounts, in smaller amounts. You can sustain someone for several weeks. And yes, they are in a dying state. You're not denying the fact they're not going to live at the end of 3, 4, or even 2 months. And sometimes people do rally. I mean, I've taken care of people who everybody thought that person would die that night.
Right.
And they would rally around and live for another 4 or 5 months. So it does happen, and it happens quite often. But if you're in a dying state, you still need to be given hydration in some way, whether it's cleaning the mouth, allowing some drinking to take place, to, and depending on the condition, how much hydration mm-hmm. they would receive. If their kidneys are functioning, still functioning well enough, then you can give them more water if they're not in congestive heart failure.
Well, it seems to me, you know, a lot of times they'll say, well, the person's in pain, and, you know, we just need to get more painkillers. Mm-hmm. Like you said, they sedate mm-hmm. these people. How are the painkillers going to get to the nerve endings if the circulatory system is shutting down?
It doesn't. It doesn't, and they're in pain no matter how much medication you give them. And that's why IVs at the end of life, I believe, are beneficial. Mm-hmm. I'm only speaking from my own experience of dealing with people who I knew who were dying, who I cared for, or my mother-in-law in her case. I've seen people in excruciating pain because they were unhydrated. They were underhydrated.
Right. I mean, it is painful.
It's very painful, death.
So you're not really helping, no matter what you say, you're not helping the person alleviate pain except for the fact that you're basically killing them.
Well, it's a debate going on between two factions in the medical community. And he's pointing out what the side that I agree with, that you do need certain amount of hydration in the death process to be humane without causing additional, you know, stress on the heart. Or if they have kidney failure, you know, you're going to just fill them up and they're not on dialysis. But on the other hand, there's people who truly believe that the quicker, the faster you end somebody's life, the kinder you are. This is being written about in all kinds of nursing manuals and medical forums. There is an entire group of people who think this. And so they think they're doing the family a favor. They think they're doing the person a favor. But morally, we don't think that anyone should prematurely take a life before God has decided that
right.
life is over, and it is our responsibility as the caregivers and the relatives and the loved ones to care for that person mm-hmm. as best we can until the end of their life when God comes and decides that he will take
right.
them. And we don't preempt that and hasten that because of financial
right.
issues.
Or because it's a matter of convenience or inconvenience. Basically what you're saying to that person when you do hydrate them and do keep them as long as possible for, you know, waiting for God's will mm-hmm. is that, you know, every moment with them is a gift and you treat it as such.
I've experienced a lot of home deaths because I worked in a hospice home care settings, and I personally have gone through those experiences with relatives and friends. But I believe that hastening, you have to wait and experience the sadness and the pain. It's not easy. And that's why the majority of professionals that come into a home care situation, they carry the burden of the hard part of the death experience. That's the cleaning, the caring for, the washing of their mouth, the cleaning of their body, cleaning up whatever is happening during that death cycle. And the family comes in and they do say their goodbyes and they do all these things. And it sometimes is very painful for the family. You know, it's not easy. But they usually are doing this because, in the case of a home hospice type of home care, they're doing it because this is something they promised that their loved one.
Mm-hmm.
And personally, I would do the same. I've done that. And I would have my relatives, who I love, would be at home when they will die. Because my concern is that when they go to the hospital, they're not cared for. And I experienced that with my mother-in-law. It wasn't about money. She had all the insurance. We had everything that we could have given her, and yet every time I would go into her hospital room, her mouth would be encrusted she wouldn't be cared for. I don't believe they ever gave her mouth care during the entire time that she was at a local hospital for 12 days.
Wow.
And each time I would come in and I would clean her mouth. And the next day I would come back and it would be encrusted again. And I don't think I'm the only person. I think just about every person who has a loved one who becomes incapacitated and needs someone else to care for them and clean their mouth will experience that. They go into the hospital and find them uncared for. And you have to ask yourself, these are nurses. This is a hospital.
What are they doing? I mean, it costs an incredible amount of money every day that the person's in there. And they're just sitting them, laying them there and changing the bedpan, and that's it?
They've decided that this person is 83. This person is 93. This person is 97.
The quality of life issue.
It's over. And they're doing you a favor. I believe this. I believe that they, in our society, and as recently as today, on a very well-known program, I won't name who it is, because everybody will polarize if I name who it is, who's talking about physician-assisted suicide, and about the fact that the czar for our health care is talking about this. He's talking about cutting expenses. This is where they see that they're going to be going to cut expenses. Because the last 3 weeks of someone's life as they begin to spiral and die is the most expensive that Medicare pays out. And this is where they can cut costs. And, well, heck, the person who's dying doesn't know it, they think.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and God is not in this equation.
Yeah.
You know.
You've been removed for a while.
And the family has become, if it's best, you know, she won't suffer so much. And if you have 5 or 6 other medical people telling you this is what you should do, then
And a lot of times that's what they want to hear, you know, because it's an inconvenience. What, I have to wait 3 weeks, you know, for this person to die?
Yeah,
you know, I've got work to do. I don't want to waste my vacation time.
Absolutely a jaded society who has no patience for birth or death any longer. The most two important events in your life is your birth and your death. Maybe a marriage in between.
But that brings up a huge point, is that you know, we see this going on, and even though most states don't have physician-assisted suicide, this is really no different than, you know, it's hastening your death nonetheless, and it's probably even more painful. So what you're saying is that with, you know, this new push for, you know, to save money in health care, that it's our
future.
Dying.
It's our future. I think all of us should be concerned. Every single person in should be concerned. If you're young, you have a while to go. But if you're
maybe
in 50 or 60, you know, it could be happening 10 years from now or 20 years from now. You know, a lot of people do rally from a serious illness as well. Once they get into the routine of giving poor care to what they consider the person who's going to die, that they're certain they're going to die, there's always going to be that person who doesn't die, and you give them poor care, and they do die.
Right.
So this is, it's a slippery slope, and it keeps moving itself backwards. And this is what those who don't think that they're really going to be affected by this will be affected by this. And you will have, it will befall out everywhere about these cost-saving type the 3 to 4 weeks that it costs to care for a dying person or a very sick person. We're going to constantly be hearing, this quality of life,
they're
going to just move it right up. But with universal health care, this is very serious. This is not something that any person should walk away from without understanding that quiet euthanasia is taking place right now. It happened 5 years ago to myself with my mother-in-law.
Tell us a little bit about that. So you were in the situation where you had a loved one that you were taking care of. How can somebody, what are we supposed to be looking out for? And how do we take care of our loved ones?
Well, I think that an elderly person, the first thing that starts to show a sign is their swallowing ability. It could be a bladder infection. It could be a renal failure. It could be a swallowing problem. And these are all life-threatening situations for an elderly person, and especially the issue of eating and drinking. And that's what happened to my mother-in-law. She was a delightful person. She was 93 years old. She took care of herself until she was 92. The last year, she couldn't walk well, and she came to live with us. And then she had problems walking, and she was having a cough. She would cough when she ate. And I said, you know, you've been doing that for a whole week, and I really should find out why you're coughing when you eat. And I, you know, one day, one Sunday, I said, I'm going to take you to the emergency room. We're going to find out why you're doing that.
So you're expecting like an x-ray or CAT scan or something to test to figure out what's going on in the throat?
She wasn't vomiting. She didn't have a fever. Yeah. She wasn't sick. There was nothing for me to believe that there was anything that serious with her that maybe an antibiotic wouldn't fix.
Right.
Or there was just an insignificant little problem.
Right.
At the emergency room, they rejected her. They told me to take her home. There was nothing wrong with her, and they couldn't admit her. All the guidelines for admitting someone, she didn't meet them. And I said, but why is she coughing? And they said, under a technicality, we'll admit her. And under a technicality, they admitted her. And I had sent her with thickened liquids. I'd been given her thickened liquids, and I told them that. But for 2 days, they gave her unthickened liquids. At the end of 2 days, she had pneumonia. And she had pneumonia so bad that she was on death's door.
Wow.
And dying.
Now, she aspirated her food? Is that what happened?
Evidently, this is the next step. After the second day, when they did evaluations, they found that her throat, it was going into her lungs, and that the muscle was shot. It was never going to go back to closing, and
that was why she was coughing.
And this happens quite often to elderly people. I don't think there's a whole lot of research done on why. Age is the one reason they give for this, but it could be that you take medication and the medication destroys
the muscle. Yeah.
It could be other conflicting things. But here she is in perfect shape, and suddenly this is the one problem that she has. And within 2 days of being in a hospital under doctor and nursing care, she's now dying.
Right. From pneumonia.
When they gave her a clear bill of health in the emergency room.
They were trying to send her home. Right.
And then they say, when I was trying to feed her, they said all her food has to be honey consistency. And
well,
then,
that's pretty much what you were giving her to begin with.
Well, it wasn't quite that thick. I was more the pudding consistency. Yeah. And then you go to honey means that you can hardly get it out of the spoon.
Oh.
And they were... Then they came in and said, oh, you can't do that. And I says, why not? Because the swallowing therapist is going to come in and show you why. And then they showed me a film, and they said, nothing by way of mouth. And that meant, and I said, well, how is she getting her fluids? How is she getting hydrated? What's sustaining her? And they said, the IV drip. And she'd already, she was in terrible state. Mm-hmm. She looked like she was dying. She was. And I went to the supervisor of the hospital, and I demanded to know, one, her mouth was all loaded with all this stuff, and I demanded to know what they were going to do. And I asked why they didn't suggest a feeding tube. And they said, well, our families don't do that. Our families don't do that. So what she's saying is our families just let their old people die. That's really what she was saying. They don't put feeding tubes in. So it would take approximately 3 days for her to go into a further dehydration, and she would be in a spiral to die if we didn't immediately put a G-tube in. And I said, that's it. Get a G-tube in her as soon as possible. Well, that takes 24 hours to do the surgery and then to access so she had to live on an IV. And the supervisor, as she's looking at the IV, she said, oh, you know, that IV is not enough fluids to hydrate a person. That you wouldn't be properly hydrated with that IV. So she said, so she was doomed to die at that very moment. No one came in and appraised us of she's going to die in 3 days or 4 days.
Or even told you what your options were or gave you any kind of a choice or any kind of any information, really.
No, nothing. No, there was no advocate.
So if you didn't know better, if you're the average person mm-hmm. that went in, you would have just accepted their prognosis and wouldn't have known, one, that they caused her pneumonia, and two, that they were...
They never admitted that they caused the pneumonia. And when you try to bring in facts to them, you can't discuss facts with the hospital. They're not going. They're not held accountable for anything or anybody, or what they did in the emergency room isn't what they're doing on the floor, and nobody knows anybody else. So there was no way that they were going to link that a perfectly healthy person. It appeared, aside from her problems with her swallowing, did not have pneumonia, because remember they had x-rays.
Right.
And the fact that the doctor was saying, I can't keep her, there's no pneumonia, she doesn't have pneumonia. And yet 2 days later she has pneumonia so severe that she's dying.
Yeah.
And they don't think she's going to survive.
So you get the feeding tube in there, mm-hmm. and what happens to her?
It was like a wilted flower.
Oh.
She just... Suddenly, in fact, the doctor had come in earlier before the G-tube was inserted and said, because we're dealing with staff doctors all the time.
Mm-hmm.
That's the latest thing, and that was 5 years ago. They were coming in, the staff doctors in the hospital that are paid by the hospital and are full-time. Those doctors are the doctors that will oversee a patient if their own doctor is not have privileges
in that hospital.
So you're at their total, you know, their total
mercy.
Yes, their mercy. He said that she always is crazy, and I said, no, it's because she's dehydrated.
Yeah.
You know? And as soon
it's amazing what it does to your mind.
And as soon as the hydration was done, she rallied around. She could talk. She was coherent. Once the G-tube was, the nutrition was put into the G-tube and she was properly hydrated with water, she totally returned to a normal person.
Wow.
And she lived for another year and a half.
And did she ever talk about that? I mean, did she know that she was on death's door and that, you know, the G-tube had brought her back? I mean,
well,
she
94,
able to...
they're not too right. intellectual about those things. They just, it's like... You know, that you survive one day to the next.
Right.
But I think, you know, for about 6 months she had optimum health. And then she did go downhill. And G-tubes, you know, they don't sustain you forever. And you can't catch pneumonia with a G-tube.
So I want you to come back so we can talk a little bit more about how all of this is going to be expedited and become even more prevalent with our cost savings due to health care reform.
Okay.
But thank you for sharing with your story with us today. Mm-hmm. Thank you for joining us today. We hope that you've learned something. We hope that when you talk to your family and friends, you tell them about preventing their loved ones from being dehydrated to death, because it's a painful death. And when you look in the mirror the next time, we hope you realize yours, too, is the face of pro-life. Please join us next time.